This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Chris Hermes about John Timoney and the Kingdom of Bahrain.
What happened to Arab Spring in Bahrain? Why are they hiring crowd enforcers, cops from the United States?
In the aftermath of last week's ousting of Egyptian President Morsi, we are joined by an Egyptian activist to explore underlying economic issues. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, thanks for joining us by phone from upstate New York.
It's good to be with you. It's been a very hectic week. The latest news, of course, was that the plane carrying President Evo Morales, an official plane from Bolivia, was forced to land in Austria. It was returning from Russia, where Evo Morales and a number of other Bolivians had attended a conference on natural gas, and they were coming back to Bolivia, and apparently some people or some countries thought that perhaps Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, was on that plane. And when the Bolivian plane, an official plane, having diplomatic coverage of it for sure, attempted to refuel in either France or in Spain, they were told by France and Spain, and subsequently apparently Italy, that the plane could not land there. From what I've read, the pilot had a message that said he wasn't sure about how much gas he had and he had to land, and at that point, the plane was allowed to land in Austria. So the idea that countries wouldn't let the plane either fly over them or refuel them because of a belief that Ed Snowden was on the plane is a violation of every principle of international law I know. It's also a violation, assuming Ed Snowden had been on the plane, which apparently he wasn't, although none of us know, but apparently not. It's a violation of his right to seek asylum because no country is permitted to interfere with an individual's right to seek asylum. As we speak now, it's my understanding the plane has taken off and is on its way to Bolivia. But Evo Morales, the president, and other members of the government of Ecuador were apparently kept for some 9 hours or had to stay there for 9 hours. And from what I read, Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, think about this, was actually searched when he got off the plane. I mean, it's something to diplomatically scream about. My one perspective on it is if we go back to when Julian Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and was eventually given political asylum in that embassy, that the British initially threatened to go into the embassy and, quote, extract Julian Assange out of the embassy. At that point, every country in Latin America stood up and said, this is the best of British imperialism. This is them acting like they've always acted, and they fall back on the way they treat smaller countries. And so you can look at what happened recently with Evo Morales and the plane as quite similar to that big countries beating up on a smaller country, Bolivia.
In fact, Michael, the defense minister of Bolivia, Ruben Saavedra, was actually on the plane with Mr. Morales and accused the Obama administration of being behind this action by France and Portugal. He called it an attitude of sabotage and a plot by the government of the United States. They were upset because it actually put the president's life at risk because they were low on fuel.
No, it's right. It's correct. And it's very strong words, and there should be very strong words about it. Obviously, the context, which I'm sure our listeners follow, which is the incredible revelations by Edward Snowden, from the metadata on every phone call, which we've talked about, to the PRISM system of actually taking the content of our emails and our phone calls by using the excuse that they're going after 51% foreigners or foreigners who are not in the U.S., considered U.S. citizens or U.S. residents or U.S. persons because they're, quote, 51%, whatever that means, foreigners, but getting tons of our content. And then, of course, the latest set of revelations having to do with the massive spying on our, quote, allies, 500,000 emails and letters a month from Germany alone. And to me, the most remarkable was that in Belgium, in Brussels, They have the NATO headquarters, which we all know, and right down the street is the European Union and European Parliament. And so from a few blocks away, the NATO headquarters apparently surveilled and wiretapped and put bugs in fax machines at the European Parliament and the European Union. Now, Michael has a word he wants. Michael Smith has a word here.
The Snowden revelations show that the NSA spied on 38 different countries, including France, Portugal, and Spain. Nonetheless, even after they'd been spied on, France, Portugal, and Spain said that the plane that they thought Snowden might be on couldn't land in their country. So even though the United States is spying on them, ultimately they're partners with the United States. And that's in fact what Putin said in not wanting to help Snowden. So that's where their allegiances actually lie. The United States and its British partner planted bugs on the undersea optic fiber cables so that they're able to get all the communications that go underneath the Atlantic. Quite amazing. And also there's wide belief that the stuff that the United States would be utterly illegal in doing, other stuff, they had the British do for them.
We've been sharing signals intelligence with the UK, Australia, Canada, New Zealand under the Five Eyes Agreement since after the Second World War.
Yeah. A couple of other points on this continuing and unfolding remarkable series of events was that this week, Amnesty International in USA issued a very strong statement in support of Ed Snowden, made a couple of really amazing points. Basically, they said that the U.S. authorities' relentless campaign to hunt down and block whistleblower Edward Snowden's attempt to seek asylum is a gross violation of his human rights. Then they say it's enshrined in international law, that his right to seek asylum should not be impeded. It goes on to say about U.S. efforts to pressure other countries to do likewise, and it also talks about what would happen if Snowden were ever brought to trial in the United States, saying that it's very likely he would it would raise serious questions as to whether he would receive a fair trial in the United States because of the way they've treated prior people brought to the United States for trials, and that Snowden's being charged primarily for revealing other governments and the U.S. government's unlawful actions that violate human rights. Very strong from Amnesty, obviously a lot of support out there for Snowden. And as we close this small update, today as we're recording here on July 3rd, it is Julian Assange's 42nd birthday. So happy birthday, Julian Assange.
Happy
birthday. Inside the Ecuador embassy.
Michael, what's happening with the hunger strikes at Guantanamo?
The hunger strike, unfortunately, is still continuing, and it's necessary to continue, sadly, because despite Obama's nice fancy words again in May of this year that he wanted to close Guantanamo, he would lift the restrictions on Yemen, etc., but he hasn't released one person since then, not one, and he has the authority under the waiver provisions of the U.S. statutes governing this to release people to Yemen immediately. 55 people have been cleared for release to Yemen. He could do that tomorrow. But instead, he does nothing except blame Congress when, in fact, it's right at his feet. So the hunger strike is continuing. 106 people have joined the months-long hunger strike. It's been over 4 months, and they're continuing to do that. Now there have been a series of objections based on the forced feeding, because that's what they're doing, and considering it a violation of the detainees' human rights to be force-fed. You have a right under both ethical rules as well as international law to make your own medical decisions about your life, and that includes your right to starve yourself till the very end. And they're interfering in that right, and that is a gross violation of human rights. And they're interfering in a way that is the most painful for the people at Guantanamo, which people I'm sure are familiar with, the chair, the restraint chair that you're strapped into, and then a large tube forced down your nose. And that is the way they do force feeding. In what can only be seen as the impossible-to-believe category, the military puts out a statement this week as we're recording this that they will continue force feeding, but they will obey the rules of Ramadan. So you won't be fed, force-fed, between the morning and the evening, but only force-fed when Ramadan during that day is over. Ramadan, meanwhile, starts on July 8th, Monday, in the evening. So from then on, people at Guantanamo will be force-fed only after sunset. That reminds me of the courtesy they showed the Rosenbergs, because it was the Jewish Sabbath, so they didn't execute them until after the sun went down.
Michael, I understand Jim Lafferty is with you to talk with us briefly about how the lines are continuing to blur between law enforcement and the military.
Jim Lafferty has the Lawyers Guild show in Los Angeles, and in fact, it was his show that inspired us. Jim is the organizer of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles. Jim, welcome to East Coast Law and Disorder. Jim, I wanted to ask you, because I know that you've interviewed somebody knowledgeable about this and have read the provisions, there's a new United States military power grab that's gone into effect. And can you tell our listeners what this means?
Yeah, let me just borrow your glasses, if I might, for a while, so, Michael. Yeah, it puts the civil rights, civil liberties community for some decades now has been concerned about the militarization of local policing. It isn't just the style of policing that our local police departments do now that they've learned at the hands of the military, but of course they also have the equipment as well, the military equipment as well. We've seen that used in various occasions at the time of protest around the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, for example, convention in New York. Well, not satisfied with that, there is a new regulation that has been put into effect, which essentially allows the military to intervene in contravention of decades of law and policy and practice to the contrary, of intervening in domestic unrest, civil disputes, civil unrest. And in fact, what it says is that the federal military commanders now have the authority in extraordinary circumstances where prior authorization by the president is not possible, and duly constructed local authorities are somehow deemed to be unable to control the situation, the military can engage in activities that are, quote-unquote, necessary to quell large-scale, unexpected civil disturbance.
Evincing a shameful lack of humanity, the head of the United States Department of Prisons has denied compassionate release for Lynn Stewart. Please go to lynnstewart.org and help continue to put pressure to bring Lynn home. That's lynnstewart.org. 2 years since the Arab Spring demonstrations erupted in Bahrain, human rights abuses continue to this day. In 2001, an independent report exposed these abuses that compelled the Kingdom of Bahrain to hire former NYPD police chief John Timoney to whitewash acts of political repression. Who is John Timoney, and why was he contracted out to Bahrain? We asked legal worker and journalist Chris Hermes, who recently penned the article John Timoney and the Kingdom of Bahrain, Whitewashing Human Rights Abuses and Suppressing a Popular Revolution. Welcome, Chris, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, we're interested in a lot that you've done, but the particular thing that brought you to our attention was the article you wrote on the Kingdom of Bahrain and a man named John Timoney. And of course, Bahrain gets in the news, you know, somewhat, but it gets a pass, really, because I know it's the home of the Fifth Fleet, and, you know, Saudi Arabia was allowed to go in there and put down the what might have been another Arab Spring there. It doesn't play a particularly progressive role in the Middle East. But can you give us some sense of Bahrain, what it is, what's going on there? Why is it important?
Sure. It's a small Persian Gulf country that, as you mentioned, there are strategic interests that are served by the United States being allied with Bahrain and the monarchy that rules there. Shortly after the Arab Spring began in early 2011, Bahrain followed in the footsteps of Tunisia and Egypt by demonstrating against the ruling monarchy that's been in power for more than 200 years. Those protests were met with intense repression by King Hamad, And the protests notably have been made up of a majority Shiite population who argues that they have been systematically discriminated against in employment, housing, education, and so forth. So there are very valid reasons for people demonstrating in Bahrain, but their ability to do so is significantly diminished compared to some of the other Arab Spring countries that have seen popular revolutions over the last couple of years.
I know there's been a lot of repression, and it's talked about a lot of repression, and they sent this human rights guy from Chicago, Sharif Bassini, over there to do a report on it and say how to improve it. What's going on with all of that? I mean, people are in jail. I think there's a guy whose name I always forget. Najib, is that his name?
Yeah, they jailed a considerable number of human rights activists. The head of the prominent human rights group there has been imprisoned, received a life sentence, actually, a couple of years ago with the initial uprising. But the thing that sparked the independent report is that during the first 2 months of the Bahrain uprising, at least 35 people were killed, and there were allegations of torture. The king was, in essence, forced to commission this study, which found significant human rights abuses, not surprisingly. And a month later, the Minister of Interior hired John Timoney, as well as John Yeh, who is from the UK, from Britain's Metropolitan Police Department, his assistant commissioner. And both of them, I believe, were brought in to smooth over the rough edges. Well, whether or not they were brought in to actually quell the repression is an outstanding question. They were certainly, at least John Timoney was brought in to whitewash what was going on, to make it appear as though the Al-Khalifa regime was improving its human rights posture.
Chris, let's talk about John Timoney. For people who aren't as familiar as you and I and Michael are, who is he and what's his background been both in the United States and as a consultant, I'm gathering, abroad?
Well, John Timoney started with a very long career, nearly 30 years with the New York Police Department. He was probably most well known for his handling of the Tompkins Square Park riots in 1988, where his police force indiscriminately brutalized a number of people in Manhattan over housing and poverty issues. People were demonstrating, and Timoney came in and brutally repressed people in the lower part of Manhattan.
Chris, I was at that riot. It was international news. Horses charging down Avenue A, police going into the very few restaurants that existed and dragging a pregnant woman out, charging. I was chased up into a stranger's apartment building. It was horrible. Just wanted to add that.
Yeah, I didn't realize Timoney was in charge of that. But he's truly a bad guy that was trained here and now exported. But wasn't he also in Miami and also in Philadelphia?
Well, he was. Before he left the New York Police Department, he became the deputy commissioner there, and that helped to launch his career, excuse me, as the Philadelphia Police Commissioner in 1998. And he was brought into Philadelphia to clean up what was being accused corruption and a dysfunctional police force in Philadelphia, and there have been reports over decades of the Philadelphia Police Department brutalizing its citizens and not being held accountable. So Timoney came in, and regardless of what he did to clean up the Philadelphia Police Department, his handling of the Republican National Convention protests were abysmal. And he came down very hard on demonstrators in 2000 during those protests, essentially establishing a new form of policing in the United States that was, for the most part, intolerant of political demonstrations. He then moved on to Miami. He became the police chief of Miami in 2002. and then oversaw one of the most violent police reactions in modern history during the November 2003 Free Trade Area of the Americas protests. He not only took what he learned from Philadelphia in conducting preemptive raids, using infiltration and heavy surveillance, brutalizing protesters on the streets, and wrongfully arresting hundreds of people. In addition to those tactics, in Miami, he used a whole panoply of weapons against protesters, including tear gas, pepper spray, rubber and wooden bullets, beanbag rounds, tasers, and electric shields, not to mention fists and clubs. So he gained a reputation both in Philly and Miami, but in particular, his way of policing in Miami compelled the mayor at the time, Mayor Manny Diaz, to say that Miami's way of handling the protests was a model for homeland defense. Shockingly, that became known as the Miami model of policing political demonstrations. And his career as someone who somehow was tolerant to dissent but could handle demonstrations without protesters getting the better of political situation propelled him onto the national stage, really international stage.
That's what interests me, Chris, that this constabulary, if you will, internationally is supported. It's not just that the United States has troops in all these countries around the world, but it also trains and exports cops. Let's talk some more about Timoney, the American-trained cop, now exported to Bahrain. Who pays for him? Follow the dollar. What's at stake there?
He has gone on various excursions internationally to train police. And this is his most recent contract. He's been in Bahrain for about a year and a half now, and apparently has a two-year contract. So it's just about up. That's actually the reason for the article that I wrote, is an assessment of how Timoney has done in Bahrain in terms of his crowd control measures.
Who pays the company he works for that sent him over there?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm unclear where Andrews International gets its funding from, but I would assume it comes from private and governmental sources. It's a fairly large internationally based security firm, which has contracts all over the world. So I think it's part of an apparatus that is increasingly private in terms of security and policing personnel that are deployed around the world, not just in terms of consultancies like Timoney's, but also private contracts that allow the U.S. to expand its militia around the world as well.
That's a really important point, I think. After all, it was Edward Snowden worked for a similar kind of company, Booz Allen, that contracted with the national security apparatus here in the United States. They've privatized not only the national security spine, but they've privatized the cops and then send out these consultants. What did you conclude from your research about this guy? What is the take home about what people should know about this?
Well, I mean, if you look at the statistics in Bahrain, you'll find, at least based on human rights groups' allegations, that the death toll of political demonstrators has only increased since Timoney arrived on the scene. One of his favorite tools used to suppress protests in the United States has been tear gas. That has been used in a widespread way. I should note, to be fair, tear gas had been used by the Al-Khalifa regime before Timoney arrived on the scene. However, the deaths from tear gas inhalation have only increased since he showed up. You know, we're talking at least 25 people who have died as a result of excessive tear gas inhalation. And added to that, 5 people have died as a result of tear gas canisters being shot directly at people. and that's been a problem in the United States as well, as we've seen in Oakland and other places, people being shot point blank with tear gas canisters, which you know, are not supposed to be used with deadly force, but often are.
Have any of the demands that the protesters raised, has there been any success there? Is there any progress?
No, and you know, let me just say that that the statistics are dire, and protesters are continuing to be repressed. Reporters and human rights observers are being kept out of the country. United Nations rapporteur on torture has been refused entry, as have numerous reporters trying to come in to investigate the situation. So it's difficult to get a proper assessment, actually, at this point, and we're relying on people's assessment from inside the country, people who live there. But no, the situation has not changed in terms of the demands, the political demands being made by people on the ground. Certainly, the U.S. has a huge role to play in this by maintaining silence or complicity with the Bahraini government. It could suspend arms sales. We're currently funding arms to the Kingdom of Bahrain. We could better bring accountability to the officials in the country who have been intolerant to protest and have exacted human rights abuses on the people. None of that is happening. Concessions that the kingdom had made after the independent panel issued its report in late 2011 are not even being met in terms of what they said they were going to do to improve the situation. So things are pretty dire for political dissidents in Bahrain at this moment.
Chris, we only have a few minutes remaining, but I wanted to ask you about accountability and Andrews International. Given, as you've suggested, that the death rates have actually increased since Timoney's arrival, are there any potential claims against this private security company?
Well, that's a very good question. It seems like the people of Bahrain should be able to hold Andrews International responsible for the abysmal record of Timoney and their efforts in the country. Whether or not they can be successful, whether or not Andrews International or Timoney can be held accountable for their actions is another story. But certainly that should be an avenue to explore.
I think that's a problem we've seen, and I'm sure you're familiar with, Chris, is that we have military contractors doing the business of death in other countries, and they're in many cases found to be immune in courts of law.
Yeah, I don't think that's a mistake that we've seen an increase in contract military personnel and security personnel, really to avoid accountability and to put several layers between the people who are being abused and those who are trying to quell political dissent.
Of course. Disturbing pattern. Now, Chris, before we let you go, we just wanted to say you've been a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild, a very active member of our National Mass Defense Committee, traveling around to various protests, monitoring police abuses. You're in Chicago now, and what are you working on aside from your fine writing projects?
Well, actually, I am writing a book on Timoney's legacy, how the protests in Philadelphia in 2000 against the Republican Convention made a mark on U.S. political policing and Timoney's role in that. These days, I'm helping to shine a light on some of the surveillance and infiltration that's been going on around the country, most recently helping with the port militarization resistance out of Olympia, Washington, and a lawsuit involving the military spying on political dissidents in that part of the country.
And we had Larry Hildes on a few weeks ago. That's such a crucial case.
Absolutely.
Chris, we really look forward to reading your book and having you back on as a guest. Best of luck
thank
with
you.
All your work, and thank you so much for all that you do on behalf of civil liberties.
Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Last week, democratically elected Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi was ousted following historic demonstrations by protesters. Morsi and his advisors have been held under house arrest in the Egyptian Republican Guard Club. The highest Brotherhood leader, Mohamed Badi, and some of his associates have also been arrested. Protesters have accused Morsi of supporting Obama's anti-Syrian agenda, ignoring critical economic problems, and betraying his support for Palestinians. But what are some of the background issues that led up to these unprecedented protests? We're joined by Omar El-Shafai, an Egyptian activist and independent researcher, who analyzes the massive uprising from an economic and trade union perspective. Omar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being with us. Now, we're at really a historic crossroads in terms of what's happening with Egyptian demonstrators. Tell us what you see as the import of this moment right now.
Yes, I think it's without exaggeration, one can say that we're going through a real historic process. Days ago, Egypt witnessed what is probably the biggest mass mobilization in all history, not just Egyptian or Arab history, but I think world history. I mean, estimates differ, but people agree that at least you had 20 million people in the streets expressing their anger in different Egyptian cities, including small provincial towns on the 30th of June. And this mobilization is continuing. So in this sense, this is incredibly historical, and it is, of course, a continuation of the huge revolutionary process that started in January 2011, which is not just an Egyptian but an Arab phenomenon. So we can, I think, speak of a new uprising which is representing a second wave in the Egyptian revolution.
And what do you think really sustains this mass mobilization of people in the streets despite the violence they're confronting?
Yes, I think it is a combination of extreme sense of anger and bitterness, disillusionment at the rule of the Muslim Brotherhood. We have to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood have been the largest opposition force in Egypt during the last decades of the Mubarak dictatorship. And in fact, after 1 year in power now, they managed to alienate everybody. They essentially are ruling as a continuation of the old regime. So basically, they are counter-revolutionary as to their socio-economic policies, perpetuation of the despotism of the state apparatus, continuing the same lines of pro-imperialist foreign policy. And at the same time, they are actually adding to this continuation of the old regime a huge part of incompetence also. And this incompetence has played a role in alienating not only the people at large, the masses that made the revolution, but also actually an important part of the old state apparatus. And hence, the paradoxical character of of the huge mobilizations that is going on today. It is true that this is a massive continuation of the spirit of the revolution, but at the same time, you have also, as
part and parcel of the mobilization against the Brotherhood. People and forces who are not revolutionary in any sense of the term, but who are essentially alienated by the Brotherhood and perhaps even wanting a certain kind of restoration of the old regime without this incompetent reactionary religious government at the top of it.
You are author of Workers, Trade Unions, and the State of Egypt, 1984 to 1989. Tell us a bit what's happening from a union worker perspective. How are things changing?
Okay, actually, this question relates to the nature of this revolution. The dominant image of the whole so-called Arab Spring is that of, you know, a purely political, purely middle-class, youthful mobilization aiming at democratizing despotic regimes. Well, this is part of the reality, but it's a simplified version of what is going on, because the Mubarak dictatorship and much of the dictatorships, actually, against which these revolutionary processes have erupted in the Arab world, have also been regimes that for years and sometimes for decades have applied neoliberal economic policies that tremendously increased class divides. So the social element of this revolution was vital. In the case of Egypt, the revolution in 2011 came after 5 years since 2006 of the biggest wave of worker struggle in the history of the country, maybe since the 1940s. And in fact, during the huge 18-day uprising that toppled Mubarak in January, February 2011, there was a massive strike wave, especially during the last few days of this mobilization, that was really very important in tilting the balance of power in favor of the revolutionary forces and forcing Mubarak to resign. Now, if this revolutionary process that started now 30 months ago is still continuing, this is in large part because of the workers' mobilization. I'm not reducing the revolutionary struggle to this aspect, but definitely it is one very important aspect of it. So actually in Egypt, up to the revolution, we did not have independent trade unions. The trade union structure that existed was totally incorporated by the state. It was more like the agent of the state against the labor movement rather than vice versa. So since then, we have witnessed the emergence of thousands of independent trade unions, and these are playing an increasingly important role in the revolutionary mobilization, either mobilization for essential social demands such as wages, conditions of work, and so on, or also mobilization for the democratic right of independent organization by workers. And hence the potential in this movement of linking the social and the political faces of the revolution, which one has to admit has essentially been perhaps one of the important weaknesses of this revolutionary process, despite its radical potential.
Can you address how you think that bodes as a message for the rest of the world? Do you think other countries could model uprisings based on a similar paradigm?
Well, yes and no, I think. Yes, in the sense that we've already witnessed how the revolutionary process in the Arab world, and I think especially in Egypt with all the symbolism of the Tahrir Square, for instance, has already inspired much upsurges that we witnessed in the world, especially in 2011. I'm thinking here of, you know, in Europe, especially in Spain, of the Indignado movement, and of course in the United States, crucially, the Occupy movement, which clearly in an important part was inspired by what was going on in Egypt and especially Tahrir Square. But in this sense, the answer is yes. And when you have, since days ago, more than 10 million people on the street, in the midst also of an important wave of worker strike, this has to be inspiring in a context of a capitalist world crisis-ridden and in which struggle is fundamental, really, to transform things. But so in this sense, the answer is definitely yes. But at the same time, we have to also not underestimate the specificity of what is going on in the Arab world. I mean, in part, this revolutionary process has been sparked by the fact that you have a definitely exceptional level of despotism in this part of the world. I mean, I just mentioned that in Egypt, you did not even have the equivalent of trade unions. In this sense, one can argue that much of the struggle that is going on in the Arab world is about basic democratic demands that have been gained in other parts of the world. What is interesting as a radical potential, I think, and something that can inspire the rest of the world, is how the fact that the movement from below, the massive struggle from below, even when it is for apparently limited demands, it has the potential of raising people's confidence and hence a potential of a process of self-radicalization that can link these limited demands to a wider vision of transformation in society. And in this sense, I think that definitely there is a two-way relationship between what is going in the Arab world and elsewhere. Definitely one can argue that part of the feeling that things can change in Egypt today is inspired by the huge mobilization we witnessed a few weeks ago in Turkey. One has to remember that for the Muslim Brotherhood who are in power in Egypt, the Turkish model is considered, they always speak of the Turkish model, even though, in fact, Egypt is even very far from the Turkish model. This is another question maybe we can go to. But definitely what happened in Turkey a few weeks ago, and then Brazil also more recently, has also very much inspired the Egyptian struggle. So it goes both ways, I think.
What do you see the future of trade unions in Egypt in the next few years?
Well, I think definitely one can speak of a great radical potential and at the same time huge obstacles that one has not to underestimate to the realization of this potential. What I mean by this is that on the one hand, you definitely have in Egypt a militant workers' movement with new trade unions that are hardly recognized by the state and hence that are not very much, bureaucratized. They don't have a crippling conservative or reformist tradition preventing their further radicalization. So all this gives a big potential for development and further deepening of this revolutionary process. But on the other hand, you also have a workers' movement which historically has been, in the last decades, and because of the dictatorship, highly alienated from politics. So until today, even though the revolution has realized great breakthroughs in people's confidence and capacity to organize and to wage their struggles, but still there is this relative gap between the economic and the political. And in fact, the greatness of the 18-day uprising that toppled Mubarak was that this gap seemed to be bridged, especially during the last few days, the 8th, 9th, and 10th of February 2011, when you had huge, massive mobilizations against the regime, and at the same time, a nearly general strike, and the two have merged together somehow. Since then, part of the problems of the revolutionary process is that this relative separation we witnessed it again. So I think that the workers' movement has a huge potential, but also there is a need of huge struggle, really, in order to further politicize it, to manage to link specific and economic demands to a wider political vision. There is definitely the potential for that, but this potential needs also to be realized. And this will be, I think, definitely one of the important challenges of this revolutionary process. And on this, will depend also, I think, the fate of the Egyptian revolution.
Can you speak briefly about the military and what potentially could happen?
Yes, this is, I think, a very crucial question today because, you know, the military in Egypt has been the backbone of the state, and Egypt is one of those states in the Middle East that have described, I think, rightly by the notion of ruling but not governing. The military was not directly in power under Mubarak, but it was somehow ruling. It was in the background, supervising the despotic state and guiding it without being on the surface of power. Now, with the toppling of Mubarak, the military actually had to come forward and to take power directly. In the first place, it did so in a way that was popular because it seemed that the military actually has taken the side of the people against the dictator, Mubarak. But in reality, we soon discovered that, yes, they did topple the dictator, but not the dictatorship. And in a matter of 1 year and a half in power, the ruling Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has lost tremendous popularity. And with Muslim Brotherhood coming to power, largely actually in agreement with the military retreated back to the background, I think, in a way that was more comfortable for it. Now, what we are witnessing today is this huge mobilization against the Muslim Brotherhood. And at the same time, given the weakness of other political alternatives and the general weakness of the opposition, the military is gaining back lots of popularity. Many of those masses who are revolting are aware that a certain kind of military intervention is needed in order to force Morsi and the Brotherhood down. Herein lies, of course, all the contradictions of this revolutionary moment. The military, I think, prefer to remain in the background. They don't want to take power, and this is what they are saying. And I think they are sincere in saying this because they experienced how much taking power directly in this revolutionary climate can be dangerous for their interest as an institution. But at the same time, they have developed, in the absence of other alternatives, of other viable alternatives, a kind of popularity that makes them, at least temporarily, a crucial player in determining the short-term result of this huge mobilization. So many people today would accept a military intervention against the Brotherhood. It would not be viewed by the population who are mobilized against the in millions of people against the Brotherhood. It won't be viewed as a coup d'etat, but then it would create a situation in which the military will be either directly or through, you know, allies in the liberals and other oppositions trying to supervise a smooth transition, as I describe it, which would be actually hostile to the interests of the revolution and its goals, and hence the potential actually of people getting disillusioned with the army, as they did before and as they are now doing with the Brotherhood. So this is to say that we are really in a prolonged revolutionary process. And I think that the people are learning by their own experiences. So today, the army in Egypt is popular and is regarded as a backbone against the brutality of the Brotherhood. But most probably tomorrow, things will change. And this is, I think, part of the excitement of what we're going through.
Omar, as you've said, we're really in the middle of a revolution. And so every day brings new exciting developments. We'd love to have you back on to talk more about this in the next few weeks or months, as I'm sure things develop.
Yeah, but with pleasure. I think it's actually developing not just on a daily basis, but every hour.
Right.
Yeah,
very exciting.
Yeah.
And we commend you on your work and really would love to have you back on soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and it would be a pleasure to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Thank you. me low, but he watch you me. At the work I go, I see my front. Money low, me ragging me. At the work I go, I don't see my back. But fashion me lay show me your real. What do you want to do bad for me? I know the sea.